Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by EscapeMaker.com. Visit a farm, escape through the net. Visit EscapeMaker.com for more.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You, of course, are listening to the Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. And today, as we will be all fall, we are continuing our discussion looking at kind of numbers and the role they play in helping us understand the scale and scope of food production in our country and in our world. Off air, of course, I am the executive director of Heritage Radio Network. You can find me on Twitter. I'm Erin_Fairbanks, or follow us, Heritage_Radio. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by a regular guest of the Farm Report, David Haight, who is the New York State Director of American Farmland Trust. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, Erin, it's great to be back with you.
I know. I can never get enough of American Farmland Trust.
And we love Heritage Radio.
It's a veritable love fest. Well,
it is.
Today we're going to be talking about some themes that are going to be coming up at your Harvesting Opportunities Conference. It's a conference happening up in Albany, New York, a little bit later this year on November 4th. I believe there are still some spaces available, and I would highly recommend you getting yours. You can find them at farmland.org. But David, today I thought maybe you could kind of take us through some of the main themes that are going to be discussed at the conference and give us a sense of kind of what's been happening around farmland and farmland conservation since we had you last on.
Great. Well, so the conference, Erin, is a gathering of people that are coming together right at the state capitol to really talk about big issues facing food and local farms here in New York, and really a diverse set of topics that are going to be in the conversation. Everything from how do we protect the land that we need to grow food to how do we support the next generation of farmers and their pursuit to find a farm and find land and get started in New York, to topics like climate change and how they're impacting our farmers and our eaters, how their climate change is affecting all of us in New York. So it's a very diverse set of topics, and we're going to have people there from state government, people from local governments, from conservation groups, farmers, food organizations, so really a great mix of people all coming together to talk about issues that are front of mind for New Yorkers.
Oh man, I am really excited. Well, before we kind of dive into some more specifics around the kind of who and the what, I want to back up a little bit and just talk about kind of why land. Why land is such an important resource for us to be kind of thinking about and dedicating, you know, money and energy. And obviously, I know you've been working for the organization for, gosh, coming up on 15 years now. So why is land such a critical part of the agriculture and food discussion?
It's fundamentally, Erin, the one of the biggest challenges we face as a society is, you know, we need to grow more food to feed more people better. And, you know, if you look at like the United Nations and others, we need to almost double food production by 2050. One of our biggest challenges in doing that is 97% of the Earth's surface is not suitable for growing food. Only 3% of the Earth's surface is actually available, the soil is suitable for food production. You know, so much of it's covered by oceans and deserts and other conditions that really you can't farm on. So there's really only a small slice of the Earth's surface that's available to us for growing food. And tragically, we have been destroying that precious soil by paving it over with concrete for new real estate developments, poorly planned developments across farms, and by poor farming practices. So we've been destroying that precious soil by the acre, by paving it over, and by the inch with how we farm on it.
So by the acre and by the inch, so you mean kind of the amount of land that we're covering. And by the inch, what are you talking about there?
Well, when we talk about the inch, we're really just talking about how farmers care for the soil.
Okay.
And so, you know, how they're actually, the types of farming practices they're using, the intensity of those practices, and their investment in the health of the soil itself.
Okay. So, I mean, things that might fall into that category, I guess what that brings up for me, I'm like thinking about topsoil and erosion and other kind of techniques that degrade the kind of quality of the soil.
Yeah, soil's a living thing. There's a lot of creatures that are actually in the soil. And so some of it's focusing on, you know, literally protecting the soil and its physical properties so it doesn't erode away. But there is a huge movement in this country of farmers that are investing in the biological components of our soil. So they're using things like cover crops, and they're actually reducing or eliminating the plowing and the tillage of land to try to really improve the organic matter in their soil, in part so that when we get really heavy rain or we get drought conditions, that their soil is better able to either absorb big amounts of water or hold water during really dry conditions and be more responsive to climate change. So that's actually for that Harvesting Opportunities Conference I mentioned, we're going to have a big focus of that conference, or a series of workshops, really looking into those issues more deeply.
When we're talking about farmland, I mean, when AFT is talking about farmland, and you mentioned at the top of the show that, you know, 3% of the kind of world's surface area is suitable for farming. And I wonder, maybe it makes sense to kind of focus a little bit more on New York State, because that's already really big for me to wrap my head around. But I also know that's like definitely your area of expertise. When we're talking about farmland, I also want to get a little bit clear about what kind of is and isn't included. When we're looking at those numbers and we're hearing things like X number of acres are being lost on a daily basis or a weekly basis, I mean, are we talking about land that's actively in production? Are we talking about forest land? Are we talking about land that's not in production but could be? When you guys are sharing some of the kind of critical numbers for the status of farmland, can you help us understand a little bit more specifically, like what is and isn't included in those?
Sure. So New York, about a quarter of all of the land in the state of New York is in farming. And that's everything from crop land where annual crops are planted to pasture land where there might be animals grazing to even some on-farm woodland. So that's the kind of the base of the land resources we have that's currently being farmed today. It's a lot less than 100 years ago, but that's what's in agriculture today. According to the United States Department of Agriculture, since the 1980s, so you know over a 30-plus year period, we've paved over the equivalent of about 5,000 farms in New York. Nearly 500,000 acres of farmland have been converted to developed uses. So it's a very real issue for New York. It works out to be about two farms a week. So it's a real concern. It's particularly concentrated close to New York City. So places like Long Island, the Hudson Valley, have really felt the brunt of a lot of that threats to farmland.
Well, that actually leads really nicely into my next question, which is when we're thinking about farmland, what are some of the different ways we like ascertain value? Because I have to imagine that, like you said, you have the farm properties and farmland in the kind of like urban fringe areas. And then you have farmland that's like much further removed from, urban centers. So it's under less development pressure. So I can see those types of spaces really changing the kind of price or the way we think about the value of that land. But I feel like also on the other side of that, I think about, what that land can kind of produce and how we value and think about that, especially when we're talking about different types of agriculture that require really different types of land and land use. How do you start dividing out some of those spaces and looking to communicate to community officials and state officials and land trusts and individuals like myself about, where our sense of urgency should lie and kind of how we're making decisions with all these different kind of important criteria?
Well, that's a really big question you've asked, or a series of them, Aaron. I think there's a couple of things here. One is, in places like the Hudson Valley or on Long Island, a lot of the price of farmland is driven by what non-farmers are willing to pay. And those can be people that are going to buy a property and they'll want to develop it, or it could be somebody that maybe just wants to own a rural property, but they really don't have any intention of farming it themselves. The result is that one of the biggest barriers for new farmers in New York and other parts of this country is finding a farm at a price you can afford. And that's largely because the price or the value of that land is being driven by other things besides what you can make on it by farming it. And so that is a huge challenge. We have strongly supported the state of New York, for example, to invest in paying farmers to protect their land for farming. And so our state's Farmland Protection Program is about to celebrate its 20th anniversary in 2016. It's provided funding to now permanently protect more than 250 farms across New York. So that's going to make it a lot more affordable for a new farmer to buy one of those farms because they can't be developed, and so that those rights are stripped away. And so that's just one example of where state leaders can really have an impact on these issues.
Do we make state like policy decisions around land in other areas like this? I mean, I'm familiar with the protecting land, removing development rights from land. Is that something that happens in other ways when we think as like like one of the things I was surprised to see in the lineup and I want to talk about a little bit is eminent domain and other spaces where we make decisions about what we do and don't want where. I'm just wondering, is farmland like any other type of land use or building use, or is it really very different from other decisions we make around how we use our physical space?
Unfortunately, for too long, many community leaders have seen farmland as kind of simply undeveloped space that is kind of an interim land use until something else comes along. And that is really an incorrect way to look at farmland. It is an asset to a community that it should be embraced just like any other community need. And so as a result, we have situations in the conference, as you noted, where we've had situations in New York where governments are taking farmland to expand for roads and for the expansion of new water and sewer lines or other types of public utilities. And part of that is because there's just not enough value placed on farming and local food production in New York. And so that is absolutely going to be one of the things that comes up at the conference. I know another one of our sessions is going to focus on publicly owned land. And the state of New York actually owns a lot of farmland. There are prisons in this state that have prison farms that were shut down. And some are being used for farming, but more could be, and certainly could be a place for new farmers. And there's plenty of other state land that we're aware of that could be used for farming. There just isn't enough recognition of the importance of having good land available for farmers, particularly new farmers.
So kind of thinking about making state land accessible for farmers, one of the things that immediately brings to mind for me is, you know, as a farmer, again, when I'm thinking about this idea of value of my land, value of my business, I feel like that's where kind of ownership plays a really critical role. I can't think of many business owners who are willing to invest in a piece of property that they don't own or don't have a sense that they're going to be able to be there long enough to recoup those investments. So as a farmer, if you're adding infrastructure onto the land and you're developing the soil, I mean, what do we need to think about to kind of protect those types of investments for producers who are going to be growing food in public spaces or in spaces where they are not owners?
So that's a great observation, and I think it is something that we need to address head on if you're going to have a farm leasing situation. I guess first off, farm leasing is a viable option for people. It's not for everybody all the time, but it is common, and I think in the right situations can actually work well, particularly for new farmers that are looking to get into certain types of agriculture. That it can be a less costly way than sinking a lot of your limited funds into actually buying land, that there might be a way to get started with a little bit less investment. But you're right, you do need to protect yourself. And so being clear about the types of improvements, if any, are needed on that land, talking with the landowner about who's going to own them after your lease expires, who's going to pay for them up front, those are all really important questions to ask. There are some types of agriculture, though, certain types of field crops, hay production. There are some things that really don't require a lot of improvements. I think there's also a lot of landowners out there that are willing to help pay for some of those improvements themselves. So they're willing to pay for things like fencing or irrigation and other assets that a farmer needs. So I think it really depends on having a farmer that's looking for land really knowing what's right for them and really having that line up well with who's going to lease them the land and making sure you're all synced up in terms of expectations and needs.
Yeah, and I think it's another way that I feel like has been useful for me when chatting with people who don't really understand that you're building investment in property over time. So they're like, well, you know, you farm there and then you move your farm up the road. Like, what, you know, what's the big deal? And so I think, again, it's like kind of getting back to that value conversation around, you know, how do we value the resources that we're putting in and that knowledge, but also really thinking about the land and what impact farming is having on the land and all the different ways it impacts it. Kind of thinking again on this, like, how do we think about value across the state when there's so many different types of land and different types of agriculture production? One of the things that I think is so neat about the lineup for the conference is you have folks from, you know, the Scenic Hudson Land Trust or the Rockland Farm Alliance or the Columbia Land Conservancy. So there's a multitude of different organizations that operate at a kind of a smaller than a state level. And can you talk a little bit about why it's important to have kind of a diversity of players in the farmland conservation conversation? Like, where does AFT sit and where, how do you work with, and where do you look to really support some of these more regionally focused entities?
Well, so the American Farmland Trust is a national organization. I think we are, well, we're celebrating our 35th anniversary this year. And I think our leadership, since the start of our organization, has recognized that the idea of saving farmland, you know, in this country, that is a big endeavor, that half the land in America is in farming. And so to really make it possible to help farm families and communities make better decisions about how we care for our farmland, that is a big undertaking. And so we have long recognized the importance of having state-level and local-level partners in that effort. And here in New York, we work very closely with many different organizations, including local land trusts. There are about 30 in New York that really focus on protecting farmland, and they range from Long Island to Buffalo up to the Canadian border. That there are groups like that working across the state, and they really play a critical role in working very specifically with individual farm families and helping to permanently protect their land. So they're certainly a key player in this. I will also say we're really excited by other groups. We've got some farm-to-school organizations and organizations that are working on some other topics, as well as groups like the National Young Farmers Coalition and others that are really working on helping the next generation of farmers get on the land. So there's a diversity of partners that are a part of this.
Yeah, and even some folks from New York City.
Amen.
Farmers in New York City, no less.
That's right.
I think that's also like one of the things I find so interesting about the community gardening movement here in the city. And as we're seeing more and more kind of rooftop farms pop up, there's such interesting kind of education tools in addition to the like neighborhood beautification and meeting place and food they're producing. It's so, I think, important for folks to have a space where they can go and engage in a real way with growing food and like what it takes. And that area I feel like is like super in need of support, but also one of the things I love about the work that AFT does, and I think is really reflected in this conference, is, you know, you guys are really helping to bridge these like upstate, downstate divides and bringing people together across maybe less traditional groupings. Because when it comes to, I think, farmland production and food, we obviously all have like a stake in the conversation.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, perhaps one of the greatest examples of that is, the conversation we're going to have during the workshops about agriculture, food, and a changing climate. We're very happy that Barbara Turk from the mayor's office in New York City is going to be able to join us and talk about One NYC and the mayor's vision for creating a resilient city and how local food and agriculture fit into that. We're going to have someone from the state of California come and talk about food and agriculture and farmland issues out in California, and some recent research from the American Farmland Trust around how farmland conservation fits into California's climate mitigation strategy. And we'll have upstate farmers talking about what they're dealing with the changing weather and climate patterns. So it's really people from New York City, from upstate New York, and in that case, really coming from other parts of the country to be a part of this conversation.
One of the things, I'm really focusing on with the Farm Report this fall is trying to think about kind of the key numbers and like units of measurement when we think about agriculture and in many like kind of different spaces. And I'm wondering for American Farmland Trust, like what those key numbers are for you here in New York State or even nationally when you want to evaluate, man, how are we doing? What are the things that you kind of look at that you can really quantify in a very like hard and fast way?
That's a great question, Erin. I think there's a few metrics that we often look at, and we're about to see some new ones coming out in, I hope, the very, very near future. We not surprisingly, look at how much farmland we're losing to development. And so here in New York, the worst of times back in the 1980s and early 1990s, we were paving over about 20,000 acres of farmland a year. More recently, in the early 2000s, that have dropped to about 10,000 acres a year. And I'm very hopeful we're going to see new data come out from the United States Department of Agriculture. And I think that we're going to find that how much we're losing has dropped again, and that it will have dropped as much as 75% from where it was back at the peak of back in the 1980s and early 1990s. So that's one of the metrics we look at. I think another metric we're very keenly focused on is senior farmers and that aging farmer demographic and the amount of farmland. We have about 2 million acres of farmland in New York that's owned by farmers over 65. So these are farmers that could be leaving agriculture in the next 20 years. And so our collective success in helping them transition those farms to a next generation and not having them get lost to development, that is really big for us. And kind of the flip side is how many kind of young and new and beginning farmers we have that are getting on the land in New York. Those are a couple of other really important metrics that we're very focused on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, I want to talk about one final set of numbers before I let you go here, which of course is money, is funding. What are the streams that support the work that American Farmland Trust does? And I'm personally a donor, and I know folks out there can visit farmland.org and become donors themselves. But is that the primary funding stream, or are there other spaces we should be looking for, people we should be thanking for funding your work?
Well, certainly we depend very heavily on our members. We are a membership organization, and we really depend on people that care about having land for farming and growing food. And so we thank you, Aaron, and thanks to everybody that is one of our members. I will say, in terms of other metrics, though, and funding, one of the ones that we are very excited about is the state of New York. And this 2015, we had the highest level ever in our state's history of state funding for protecting farmland, $35 million. That none of that money comes to the American Farmland Trust, but vast majority of that money will go to paying farmers to permanently protect their land. So that is a really great news. And again, the 2016 is the 20th anniversary of our state's farmland protection program, and so we're very hopeful that the state of New York is moving in the right direction, and that we'll see more good news in next year's state budget.
Well, fingers crossed, and we'll be kind of pushing from our end down here in Brooklyn. David, thank you so much for taking some time out to walk us through the conference. Really looking forward. Again, folks, if you want to find tickets, visit them fast, farmland.org. Thanks, David. I really appreciate it. Hope to see you soon, and really great to have you on, of course.
Aaron, I love talking with you. It's always a pleasure, and look forward to seeing you sometime soon.
All right, hang tight. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will be on board with the Escape Maker segment. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Anxieties by The Landing. Oh,
visit a farm. Log on to escapemaker.com for more ideas on local weekend getaways and day trips, including orchards, farms, and wineries. Or come by Escape Maker's Yellow Tent in Grow NYC's Green Markets and pick up a guide to local agritourism escapes to the Green Market's own farmers and producers. The guide will be updated seasonally to feature farms, wineries, and destinations in New York City, New York State, New Jersey, Vermont, and Pennsylvania. Plus, Escape Maker will offer overnight packages to these destinations so you can get the full experience. No car? No problem. Escape Maker features plenty of ideas for car-free getaways, including discounts via Amtrak. There's no better time to explore outside the city. Soak up the fresh air and scenery like a butterfly and support your local farmer. Log on to escapemaker.com to get inspired and make your escape through the net.
This is Brooks Headley, the pastry chef at Del Posto in Manhattan, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Okay, we are back, and it is time once again for the Escape Maker segment. Today, we're taking a little trip up to Highland, New York. We are on the line with Becky Wilco from Wilco Orchards. Becky, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So, Wilco Orchards is a sixth-generation apple farm. Has it been apple farming the whole time?
Not necessarily. There's actually an advertisement my dad found, because they used to grow currants a lot, which we still have currants. You can find them at the market. But my dad found an advertisement in the paper. My great-great-grandfather didn't think that my great-grandfather would take over the farm, and he actually thought about selling it. So at that point, he saw it, and he realized how big of a currant farmer and berry farmer we were at that time. And throughout the years, each generation has kind of taken their own spin on it. My dad has made it into more of a pick-your-own and a direct-market farm.
So, you know, obviously folks here in New York City are used to seeing you guys at the New York City Green Markets. But if we want to come up for a visit, I mean, fall is definitely like the prime time for picking apples and for going out and like really making a day of it. And I'm wondering, you know, what are like your pro tips to have like the optimal apple picking experience?
Well, there's a couple things. Really, for us, we're a different farm than a lot of other farms. We know you guys, like you said, from coming to the market. So you already know us. You know our family. You know my dad or my brother. You get to see us every day. So really, it's your chance to kind of see us in our community. So you get to see our farm, where everything comes from. If you come on a weekday, you get to see, you know, us picking our apples, us taking the apples out, us doing what we need to do to get ready for the weekend to come to you guys. So it's a great way to kind of see our farm in a different light than you're used to. But if you want to make a whole trip of it, I mean, there's great bed and breakfast in the area. You can stay for the weekend. You can get to see Bad Seed, which is my brother's his take on the farm. He started a hard cider company, which is 5 minutes down the road from our farm. I would say pick pumpkins, apples, get baked goods. My aunt makes the baked goods. My other aunt makes the jams. Really just kind of celebrate in how many great things we have to offer.
Yeah, it's like a real family operation. So you said that, you know, each generation kind of brings their kind of own perspective and their own take. And I know when I'm thinking about kind of family businesses, especially, you know, it's 2015, there's this like whole explosion of kind of social media and different ways to communicate. And I know for farms in particular, there's this kind of constant pressure to like stay kind of in front of consumers and to stay relevant to them. I mean, how does that play into any of your work on the business? Or maybe you see like your role, that like what you're bringing to the orchard in a totally different area.
Yeah, it's hard because, you know, we're busy. So social media can be really difficult. And it's the last thing on my parents' minds. You know, they do not think about what to put on Twitter. That just never occurs to them.
Yeah,
they
mine think, either.
Yeah, like how can we pick apples? How can we make this a good year? How can we get the best things to our customers? And it's interesting because for us, you know, we try to do social media. We try, but mostly our way of keeping in contact with our customers is literally being in direct contact with our customers. So we're just a weird business model. We are not trying to reach new people. We're just by being in your community, you find us. And once people get to know us and say, we have customers that their grandparents shop with us, and that's how they know about us. Like, it's a different field. So we really get to know people by just talking directly to them and never really losing that ability to connect one-on-one with our customers instead of, we don't have to find a new way. A lot of people use social media to connect, and we don't really need to find a new way to connect, though we try to keep current.
Sure. Ask us in person, right at the market.
Yeah.
We're not hard to find. Well, that being said, I know, especially in the orchard industry, we're hearing a lot about kind of the challenges of that business in recent years, as we have more kind of extreme weather events and like changes, in temperature. We hear a lot about kind of what's happening with pollinators. I'm wondering if you can share with us a little bit about kind of how this season has been for you guys and how you're kind of planning and thinking about the growing and producing of fruit in the light of some of those other kind of changing things that like are on some levels like really out of your control.
Well, that's just being a farmer in that, we always have to deal with things that are not in our control. And that makes it... That makes you try really hard to control the things you can control. So we always try to bring our best produce, like I said, always be at the market to really be there to answer people's questions. Try to always put our best product out there, because that's something we can do to ensure that we are doing our best business. It's hard. This year we've had a great apple crop, which is amazing. We're picking a crazy amount of apples. And they all look wonderful. So that's amazing. But a couple years ago there was that terrible late frost, and we almost lost all of our peaches, lost all of our cherries. These extreme weathers where it's staying colder for a little bit longer or getting really warm so everything blooms and then goes back to normal, like frosting in April, which isn't unusual, but everything shouldn't have bloomed at the end of March. Things get a little crazy, and we just have to try and do our best with what we got. But that I don't think is any different from farming forever. That's the crazy field we've chose.
Those are just the ropes. That's what you're working with. Well, so, on the Farm Report, this fall season, we are definitely kind of trying to think about focusing on the numbers, thinking about kind of what are kind of critical like measurements and tools, and how do we kind of quantify the work that we're doing when we think about food production. So I would ask, like, for your role in your operation, like, what are some of the kind of critical numbers or even and I know, like, the units of measurement for apples, I definitely think back to, like, my time working in at a Yupik orchard, and, there's a peck and there's a bushel, but I'm like, what is a peck, or how many bushels in a peck? Some of those more kind of consumer-facing things, but then also kind of wondering about how you guys really measure your success and what are the numbers you really keep your finger on the pulse for to know kind of how is the season going?
Yeah, it's interesting. A peck is a half a bushel. So a peck is 10 to 15 pounds, a quarter of a bushel, and a half bushel is 20 to 25 pounds. So a bushel is technically 50 pounds. That's how they say it. But really, with apples, you get about 40 pounds per box of bushel or bag. When we sell at Pick Your Own, people can either pick in a half bushel bag or a peck bag. And really, with Pick Your Own, how we measure success, it's really not about, it's really about what you're seeing immediately. So it's not necessarily once we count how many bushels we've sold. It's really about things that are more random, like how full our parking lot is. Like, we are right across the street from a high school. So if the high school parking lot is full of cars, that high school parking lot can hold about 300 cars, and our parking lot can hold about 70. So if we see that that's full, we know that it's a good day.
I like
or
that.
Or things like how many batches of donut batter we've made. You know, it's if we make over 10 batches of donut batter, which one batch is equal to 36 dozen donuts. So if we make over 10, we know it's a good day. It's something that you can kind of see immediately, because when you're working and you're in the middle of it, you're not counting bushels or apples or customers. You're just seeing, like, whoa, the parking lot's full, or the donut line is out of control. Like, that's what you're paying attention to, and that's kind of the thing that keeps you going. You see that, and you're like, good, let's make sure we have donuts for everybody, you know, make sure it's good.
Awesome. Well, Becky, thank you so much for taking a little time to give us a little insight. If folks want to learn more, they can definitely find you at www.wilcoolorchards.com. But we probably recommend they go over to escapemaker.com and check out some of the great itineraries so they can get the full apple picking experience. It's been great to have you on.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.